Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. We continue our South Start series with one of Adelaide's top founders, Anthony Serravolo. Anthony is unbelievably accomplished. Born in Adelaide, Anthony carved a successful career in the US and then the UK as a lawyer turned investment banker. But Anthony tells us everything changed on September 11, 2001. Working at the World Trade Center, Anthony was heading to the office when he looked up and saw the first plane crash into the building. It was the moment that would change the world, including his own. In the fallout, many investment bankers lost their jobs, and Anthony was forced to turn to his own business ideas. Now, Anthony is known for building tech companies. First, there was Redbus Media, an out-of-home media network, and then Love Film, a DVD distribution and video streaming company that Anthony sold to Amazon for around £200 million. He could have stopped there. Instead, he moved home to Adelaide and built his next company, Sign, developing technology to make it easy for visitors, contractors, and staff to check in to the everyday locations they attend. Sign has checked in more than 20 million visitors, working with some of the world's biggest brands, as well as everyday businesses. Anthony shares his amazing story, as well as insights about winning early customers, scaling businesses, and dealing with growing pains, why he has chosen Adelaide to build his global business, and much, much more. Anthony is speaking at South Start in 2018, a conference that celebrates the collision of people, ideas, and technology, from the 21st to 23rd of November in Adelaide. Make sure you join and support Adelaide's startup community. Get more info and tickets at southstart.co. Now enjoy the interview with Anthony Serravolo.
Anthony, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Thanks, James. Great to be on.
Now, I'd love to know what dinner time was like for you growing up. What were the dynamics involved?
Dinner time. Always trying to get away from the table as fast as possible after dinner to go and do some homework or play some football or something like that. No, Adelaide upbringing, and dinner time was always talking about what had happened during the day. There was a fair bit of business talked about it at the dinner table and a bit of politics.
So it was an engaging time. I mean, it was TV off and it was time for the family to debrief.
No podcasts in the background, a little bit of TV.
That's disappointing.
Pretty engaging time. And I was an only child, so I was the focus of attention.
Much like Beggs.
Well, yeah. There you go. Great minds think alike.
There we are.
What kind of student were you?
Trying to get through junior school and high school as fast as possible in a rush. But actually looking back at school now and being a student, bit of a nerd, but also trying to play a bit of first 18 or second 18 football.
Where was this hurry? Why the rush to get through things, do you think?
Don't know. It's just been in me all the time, wanting to get through things as quickly as possible and move on to the next chapter.
And do you think that's flowed through, I guess, all the patterns and themes and phases of your business life to this point?
I think I'm slowing down a bit. It's good. Take things more in your stride and actually learn to enjoy things a bit more rather than just getting through to the next objective.
That's a bit of a cliche. Like in practice, I mean, it's completely true, but in practice, what does that actually mean for you in this day and age?
The enjoying things more?
Yeah, how do you enjoy things?
As my wife would say, who's also our CFO here, don't kill the journey. Let's really enjoy the journey and stop looking always at the end objectives and just enjoy the small victories or just even the smaller things all the time.
What was your first foray into the workforce?
I think it would probably be selling roasted chestnuts or Christmas trees at my family's vineyard up in the Adelaide Hills, trying to diversify already.
As a salesman back then, how did you go?
Oh, there'd be lots of cars driving past, so I'd used to edge closer and closer to the road to try and stop them.
Did you back then have an idea that you didn't want to just fit the normal mold, or did that develop a bit later?
Highly conflicted, James. So at one stage, I wanted to be, very much a corporate animal. Back then in the 90s, the thing was to be, a lawyer or a professional. But the other half of my brain was always thinking about, setting up businesses. So that really manifested in being a lawyer. I would look at the way that lawyers would generate so much paper. So I decided to digitize all of the paperwork and put them on CD-ROMs back in the 90s. So I just couldn't help myself throughout the whole journey.
It's interesting. Like, how did you make that transition though? So I know a lot of people, similar backgrounds, professional, great at what they do. They have ideas, but they never actually transition out of that professional into a entrepreneurial or creative type.
Yeah, really good points. And there was two major events that really happened for me to get from being a professional advisor or lawyer into starting businesses. And one was a tiny little ad in the Times in London saying investment bankers wanted, literally, with no employment details or anything. So that really got on my attention, and I jumped from law into banking. I went through 15, 20 interviews and ended up joining what was Salomon Smith Barney, or now Citigroup. So that got me back from being a lawyer much more into the business side of finance and raising money and M&A. And I was, heading down that career path. And then what then really happened for me, was a major shock, was September the 11th. So I was living and working in New York, in the World Trade Centers, 7 World Trade. And, I opened my cab door that morning, and watched the first plane, crash into the building above our heads. So, we saw all of that happen, and my investment banking career got pretty well transitioned, from a 3 to 6 month period into, there is no investment banking. So a couple of us, from Citigroup decided that we'd look at businesses and start to transition out of that. And so we were really forced quite quickly to reinvent ourselves. And again, we'd been looking at tech businesses and banking big tech companies like Netflix. Mm. And that's where we got our ideas of, how to transition those ideas into real businesses.
Mm. Yep. I mean, just coming back for one second, because every time you bring this up at a dinner party, people probably want to pick your brains about it. But what was the atmosphere like, that morning and afternoon when you're floating around New York?
Oh, well, we thought World War III had started. So without a doubt, walking along the streets around the precinct of the World Trade Centers, there was absolute shock and panic and all that sort of stuff. And when the second plane hit, everyone just ran, and I ran all the way up to Midtown and made my way out of the area pretty quickly. So,
I guess also then you're moving. You got the M&A background. You're starting to look at that different businesses, diverse range of business, but also the art of the deal and structuring deals. I mean, how important was that, do you think, in what was to come in this world of entrepreneurship and startups?
I think there's two things with that, James. I think what we learned from banking at that level was, cash is king. Look at the numbers. Really, whatever you want to do entrepreneurially, that's great. Set up great products. But what really was enshrined in us is cash flow and making sure that you had a successful subscription business or a retail business that had a cash generation, at least as a possibility. And then, what also banking and law taught me was, as you say, deal doing, the art of the possible. Mm. So the art of the possible, when you combine that with some financial discipline, and then the key spark is then to get out of that mindset of being an advisor and starting to look for opportunities and putting people together. So, my first big deal, which I was one of the co-founders and first directors of, was the Netflix of Europe, which was La Film. So that started as a reaction to what happened after September the 11th, coming back to London, thinking about what would make sense and what I wanted to do. And it was very clear that if Netflix was starting to do well with only, we're talking a million subscribers in the Bay Area, we decided that the possibilities of the Royal Mail, with 60 million people and a fantastic infrastructure like the Royal Mail, could be a huge business.
And for those who can't believe that Netflix was something other than what it is now, do you want to just describe the early principles of Netflix and Love Film?
Exactly, James. So Netflix, circa 2002, coming back from New York back to London, 1.2 million subscribers all using DVDs just in the Bay Area, hardly even in New York. the New York people that we were talking to thought they were so revolutionary by bringing to dinner parties or lunch a little red envelope with a DVD inside it. So this was really the era of still everyone going to the local Blockbuster. And in my case, what really did it for us in London is the Maida Vale Blockbuster. It was a really, really old-fashioned Blockbuster. It smelt. The DVD selection was just terrible. But DVDs back then were really, really popular. That's what you did. You watched a lot of DVDs, and actually the film industry, conversely, was very strong. So feature-length production and movie production in the UK especially, which was tax-driven by lots of incentives, London was really at the centre of the film financing production areas. So we felt that the co-founder and I, who had a film distribution entity in London, we thought the timing was right. Let's look and try to emulate what Netflix has done. And it was all started on the back of an envelope as a very simple MVP.
So yeah. What was the market like back then? So we're talking, this is the pre-streaming era. There was obviously Netflix. There's you guys. Who were the other players? Could you see where things were going, and almost not just at that DVD level, but almost post DVD at that time?
There was lots of attempts to test streaming. There was testing around streaming, and it was all very, very poor. The algorithms and the encoding of the content was actually there, but again, the internet and the ADSL connections, even in the UK, the pipes were just not ready. So it was a very deliberate strategy to look at what Blockbuster were doing in the UK. But the distribution break really came after we got the actual software working and the product started. We went and saw Tesco. So Tesco was back then just untouchable in terms of all of its e-commerce operations. It was streets ahead of, you know, where the market is today with Amazon. Tesco was really the first Amazon back then in terms of its reach and its sophistication. So we white labeled Love Film. We did a deal with Tesco where we started doing delivery of DVDs like you would do shopping back then through Tesco. Then soon other major distributors in the UK followed us, and we white labeled with them as well.
How did you get that conversation with Tesco?
Board connections. So we had the investors that came in to sign after we bootstrapped it. I mean, this company started by actually buying secondhand DVDs that were scratched. So that's how frugal and how MVP this was. We got the software working, and then we thought, oh, we need to now go and buy DVDs, but there isn't a licensing window that actually exists for the type of right that we're trying to distribute. So we actually worked out that we had to go and buy secondhand DVDs that were scratched. We then found the machine to buff them up to take all the scratches out so that they were playable. This is how these companies start. We then really decided that, okay, this was going to incur millions of dollars of capex, and we needed to build. Back then, we needed not only to build software, but to go and buy a physical DVD library, and it wasn't going to scale around secondhand DVDs. So we brought in Index Ventures, which is a prolific Silicon Valley fund, and Benchmark Capital or Balderton Capital, which was one of the seed investors or one of the primary investors in Amazon and eBay. So these guys invested with us in London, and we really started to ramp up thereafter.
I've noticed too, and we're going to jump to Sign and the latest venture, but, you know, those early big customers, I mean, is that a bit of a pattern? Because a lot of people don't want to put their, you know, their, I'll rephrase that. A lot of people don't want, have the guts to go to the big end
of
town.
You were going to say balls on the line. That's very rooster.
Yeah, they don't want to. It's like too afraid, and we'll just start here. What is it about the big customer that attracts you?
Look, I think if you want to, if you think that your product and your platform is ready for some scalability, it's chutzpah. It's going out and having discussions with Tesco, having discussions with the big end of town, and you'd be surprised how receptive some of these people on the right time at the right day and the right week can be to – you know, unknown companies coming and see them and pitching them good ideas.
And, I mean, it sounded like a pretty meteoric rise, but were there ever any moments where you thought, shit, this thing's going to fall apart? We're not going to get there.
Not really. I think it was really good timing just to start giving customers – it's problem solving. So customers were complaining about late fees, were complaining about the lack of selection. We didn't have too much resistance. There were other internal competitors in the UK that were doing smaller things, so we ended up acquiring and putting together. Love Film was actually a series of acquisitions. Yeah.
What was the strategy with the acquisition and mergers?
Just the ability to consolidate their libraries, so they'd already CapEx their libraries, but also people. There were some pretty talented people. Alex Chesterman went on after we exited out of Love Film to be the founder of Zoopla. I think he's got a knighthood now.
What are you doing with yourself, Anthony?
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, like eBay, like PayPal, the Love Film set of co-founders have been a pretty prolific set of investors and entrepreneurs in the UK.
What about the day that the deal is done, or that, you know, the exits occurred? What happened, or where were you? How did that play out for you?
Look, a little bit of controversy around Love Film. It should have and potentially could have listed, but Amazon bought 30% of the company, and so therefore, when we went to exit, it just turned out that Amazon wanted to acquire the rest of the company, and so it didn't list, which maybe had valuation issues around it. But all of the investors, all of the co-founders, you know, had very good multiples on it, and life goes on and on to the next deal.
How close, when you look at how it played out, how close was the result to those initial IMs, those initial pitch decks when you were selling the idea to investors?
I think the business actually turned out to be a lot, lot bigger. It was one of those situations actually where the initial projections were quite conservative. So the growth rates of DVD distribution over a 5 to 6 year period and the uptake, was you know, a factor of, say, 4 to 5 times some of those estimates that were put together, which probably means that we valued it too cheaply.
And so often people want to look back and go, you know, everyone knew that the Netflix was going to be where it is now, or that streaming was going to be king. But when you're at the front edge of this stuff, there's a lot of time you don't really know, do you? You just know that you're at the front edge.
That's right. And the R&D that took place at the Love Film level around streaming couldn't compete in the end. And even with the Amazon acquisition, it's only now that Amazon Prime is really coming into its own. And I don't know the numbers behind Amazon Prime, but Amazon were behind where Netflix were with streaming over the last 10 years. So that's ultimately why the board decided to exit and let Amazon fight the streaming battle.
So post-exit, what are you thinking? Where are you at in terms of your own life? What do you want to do?
Look, I like a little bit of downtime between these. I think it comes down to, you know, a model of M&A transactions. It's these businesses, unfortunately, for someone like me, can become like a series of, not transactions, but a series of episodes where you just keep on doing them and keep on going back to them. And I hate that term, serial entrepreneur, but there is seriality to it. You are, you know, a repeat offender and you keep on going back. But a bit of downtime, a bit of time in Europe and a bit of time here back in Australia to really see what the potential was like in Australia. But I decided to stay in the UK a bit longer and dabble in some other businesses and some media ventures and then ultimately come back here.
Is it a process of once you think you've got your appetite back, now you want to rush into something, or do you let the next thing organically come to you?
I think you have a series of ideas in your head, and as you get better or more experienced or older, you tend to let those ideas knock around for a bit longer and really internally test them, or test them with friends or colleagues. And I've never really, apart from Love Film, had co-founders that were thinking the same thing at the same time. It's generally me validating things, testing them, and then in the case of Sign, really, you know, putting money into them myself very quickly and being, you know, the driving force behind it.
I know we're accelerating through your story a little bit, but to come to Sign, do you remember where you were when the idea first came to you in its seed form?
Yeah, so two factors. I spent a lot of time in airports, so dealing with mobile check-in and dealing with checking into electronically checking into a plane, really got into my head because I found it very efficient and getting a mobile boarding pass before you got onto the plane and basically not having to look at your inbox or deal with paper. Mm. You know, when you're traveling around Europe a lot or on the Eurostar, so ticketing was really interesting to me. And it just dawned on me when I visited so many London or Canary Wharf offices that the whole process was just way behind. So that was one area of using your phone at Terminal 5 Heathrow and then going to a meeting in Paris, in Paris or in London, and then not using your phone and going through a paper book. So that was one aspect. But I also attended quite a few trade shows. My parents have a vineyard here in Adelaide, and so I would get on a plane when I wasn't doing some of these activities and help them with marketing, and I would go to Dusseldorf to gigantic wine shows, just huge wine shows. And you'd end up setting your iPad, you know, we're talking 2010 when iPads came out, up on the trade show stand, and you'd have your photo slideshow of your products, and then you'd tap it and you'd collect people's email addresses. So data collection and front of sale, point of sale presentation was also another big theme. And then when I got back here to Adelaide, those two things that were knocking around in my head sort of came together.
You're clearly a paperphobe.
Very unusual for a lawyer.
Hates ticketing.
He's a lawyer as well. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
That's right. You're right. With the law firm, it was, they'd call them transaction Bibles. And these things were volumes and volumes and volumes of paper. And I said, well, why are we sending out all of this paper to our clients? Let's put it on a CD-ROM.
I spent 5 years in a law firm, and if I could have taken photos of some of the guys' offices, like literally up to their heads.
That's right.
The entire office in folders and paper.
So I think I'm glad you raised that. You know, paper is actually not a bad enemy to have. Paper is a good thing to try and solve, and it's still all around us.
I mean, when you're having those early ideas, clearly you know that the process will be improved and you know the size of the market. What were your initial thoughts as to how you could attack this market because it is so broad and so huge?
Yes. So Sign started out as tackling those two issues, but really then what brings it together is a realistic, pragmatic situation that you can get some proper feedback from. So it was lucky coming back to Adelaide. Adelaide is, people always say over the years, oh, if you can set up something in Adelaide and test it, you know, you'll be fine, because that, it's actually, I think, true. I don't know why.
Is it a myth? It is. We always wonder, is it an urban legend or?
No, cliches for a reason.
Yes, it's a cliche for a reason. And it's because if you are here in Adelaide, the Adelaide market is pretty fussy. They aren't that interested in technology that's new because we are just doing what we're doing. So when you can get people here to adopt it and pay for it, it isn't a bad milestone. So I did that with the schools. So we used the MVP version of the software, which we developed here in Adelaide from 2014 onwards, really, really basic test iOS apps that didn't even have a back end were all done here in Adelaide. And we took them to all the schools. So public schools, private schools, Catholic schools. They said, done. Put it on our front desks. We want to know who's coming to our campuses, security, peace of mind. And so we got early feedback here in Adelaide, and that gave us the confidence. When you get out your first invoice and you actually get it paid, it gives you confidence to keep on doing things.
And how do you inevitably keep up with the technological changes as you're building out your idea? So, you know, I'm thinking my iPhone now does face recognition, and like, how do you map that and keep those things in consideration as you're trying to build your business?
So I think now the beauty with setting up a business in 2015 onwards with Sign versus what we did with a subscription business with Love Film, the tech stack and the tools that you can use are not that much, you know, not loads easier, but they are easier and they're more cost effective to test. So the stack now that you can do things on involving AWS, Node.js, JavaScript, the App Store, even the way the App Store has progressed between Android and iOS over the last few years has become a lot more user friendly. So you can iterate, you can get feedback, you can listen to your customers because there's better CRM systems that you can get immediate feedback. So the whole loop of evolution is really starting to get going now, where you can industrialize and get products back, better products back to your customers faster.
Was there so you're talking about schools as part of the early client acquisition. Was there a trigger in particular that comes to mind in terms of getting to the next level of growth? Were there things that you did that took you to that next level?
So Sign, just to recap, is, you know, a check-in platform. We wanted to start checking people in, just basically. Come here, come to an office, check in, go to a school, check in. And we thought, obviously, offices and schools were going to be important. But then the global real estate market really started to look at what we were doing. And we were introduced to people at JLL. We went on the red eye over to Sydney and had meetings. And pretty much instantaneously, everyone said, well, we've got paper books in some of the biggest, most prestigious offices, not only at the front desk, but in the basement. So then I started to spend a lot more time in basements of big buildings. And you started to realize, wow, there is not only one book, there's like a key book, a security cleaner's book, a visitor book. There's paper in all these huge commercial office towers, which, and industrial warehouses and retail shopping centers. And actually, again, a bit like Love Film, the more you looked into the market that you had started to test and evaluate, the bigger the implications you started to realize. So that's when you start doubling down, putting more money in yourself, starting to talk to private investors and saying, look, this is the vision, these are the clients, this is the feedback, this is real.
What about the funding in the early stages? I mean, what approach did you take? Did you just fund it yourself? Did you get a couple together? What was the method?
We in this business, you know, I've been fortunate to have a couple of exits, so had some liquidity to do some things within reason. And so I invested into Sign to get it to a revenue stage. And then once I had revenues, I was introduced to some strategic private investors, one of which is Alan Moss, who's the ex-CEO and chairman at Macquarie. So Alan met us at a conference in Sydney, and you know, within a few weeks we had some pretty good dialogue with him, and he's a prolific investor in lots of different sectors, but he takes a special interest in startup and technology businesses.
Might be a silly question, but you know, we've found in our process of funding, the moment someone's had some sort of personal experience with the core part of your business, there's just a natural appetite, or you're more advanced in the conversation because they kind of get it. I mean, this is such a simple, beautiful business that he spent his whole world in corporate life. Like, he would have got that straight away.
Pretty much. I think that's the real feedback from this level of investor. Some other people from London, New York, Alan, you know, acquaintances, not close friends, but people that we know came in on the early round, and they saw that it was just solving a real problem. But you also then get into the territory of, well, is it that easy a problem to solve that anyone could do it? And they could see that by the way that we were coming about it, not just using the iPads, but using mobile check-in, and we were doing something different.
So it's clearly evolved from what was the simple check-in through to much more. Where do you see the vision of the business going, perhaps in the next couple of years?
Yeah, okay. So we think that the workplace and the solutions and the problem solvings, because basically software is just a method of solving problems. It's a pretty good way of dealing with repetition and data storage and software. The problems that we see in the workplace across all the different subsectors of real estate and facilities and offices and schools is going to go on for the next 10 to 15 years. There's a lot of stuff to solve. And so we've gone from being a visitor business or a check-in business to now having different products and solutions that deal with workplace. So it could be how do you communicate with someone that hasn't arrived yet? So messaging and communications, businesses like Slack obviously are just taking over the world in that respect around internal messaging between an organization. So we're looking at all of the issues around that. We're looking around safety. You know, now that we're checking people in, we want them to understand what the conditions on a construction site might be like. So when you're a foreman checking in your contractors for the day, are all your 120 concrete guys and girls onto a site. There might be a particular zone that is completely off limits for the day. You need to get that vital information to everyone that's coming onto site. So we think the action around people attending physical work sites for either a meeting or to do a job or to deliver some goods is a really interesting space.
And I'm assuming the responsibility and the legalities of what employers have at stake now is far more than previously. So these, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's in terms of this sign-in stuff, probably far more important than maybe 15, 20 years ago.
I think so. And it is definitely, the legalities are different, are definitely there. People are very, you know, keen on using an iPad or your phone now, just to also make it a lot faster. Like actually writing your name and the time and the date, that's what used to get to me and really why I had to do something about it. It's just really frustrating to have to write down all these stupid details. But look, it's definitely the legalities here and in most Western countries of hosting someone at your premises and then not looking after them and then, God forbid, something happening to them. That's pretty serious stuff.
What are the hard bits for you at the moment that are frustrating or challenging or even personally, like what pisses you off?
Finding enough hours in the day. It's just, we've got a great team here. Adelaide has just been, an amazing, couldn't be happier building a company back in Adelaide. My first company really here.
Did it make you nervous at all or did you see it as an opportunity?
I saw it as a total opportunity. So, you know, there's some very, good business people here in Adelaide. So there's, you know, good people to talk to about being here in Adelaide. But, you know, with Amazon and iOS and Android and the distribution platforms out there now to get your software into the hands of either web software or mobile apps or iPad apps out to people globally, it does matter where you are because you've got to have access to talent and you've actually got to make the stuff. But you don't need to be in Sydney or Melbourne. In fact, I think we're at a strategic advantage of being here in Adelaide and we'll come on to those reasons in a minute. But to answer your question, the frustrations are just good frustrations around scaling, you know, making the right decisions about the right people at the right time to join the company, making sure you get the right people involved, finding the right technical talent. And Adelaide has got a really great source of engineers and software people. That's not a huge frustration. The frustration is around commercialization, finding other people who've actually distributed and sold at scale stuff like Sign and having them be based here in Adelaide.
So what are some of the fundamentals that you see of scaling tech companies? I mean, you're someone who's done it as an expertise throughout your career. What are those core fundamentals to actually doing that?
Listening to your client base and really listening to them early on and taking their feedback seriously early on and iterating very quickly, not once every 3 months, like once every week, like seriously getting releases and versions back out. So the first 6 months to 12 months to 2 years is product, just really getting good at that iterative cycle of innovating quickly. That's really hard to do, but it is getting a bit easier with the tools that we've spoken about. I think then is not also surrounding yourself with too many product engineers that are not distribution people. So the earlier that you can start to afford and to reinvest into distribution and sales in a startup is key as well, because ultimately you've got to sell what you've made.
And typically how does Sign do that? Because sometimes I'm assuming people don't really want, in the tech world, they don't really want to talk about call centers or cold calls or targets or, you know, like we want to talk about the technology. How have you approached sales?
Yeah. So sales, have to this point in time really been inbound. So we're lucky and that luck is not always going to remain that way. We're not cold calling. Those days are not over, but for right now where we are, we're not having to pick up the phone and call a whole lot of companies. So there's a bit of a network effect happening. So we have a pretty modest website. We have the classic attributes of a SaaS business where we offer a decent free trial, which is a proper free trial where you can actually test the software. You don't have to download it. You've got to download the apps, but not the web software. And the user experience is very easy.
So have you tweaked or changed anything that's had a dramatic kind of effect in conversions or, you know, more sales?
There hasn't been anything dramatic. It's been a steady ramp up. We've now checked in and out nearly 20 million people. And that growth has been constant and continual. And we haven't seen yet an event where we've changed our pricing or going from a 14-day to a 30-day trial where there's been a huge spike. And I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but what I can say, which is good, is that given the capital that we've had to deploy and the size team, which is at 36 of us here, we are punching well above our weight for what we could be doing with more capital around online acquisition and Google Ads and content marketing. We're doing all of those things, but not at scale yet.
And sorry, just another question, but yeah, it always fascinates because I love to know the person that's ahead of a really big company or even a company like, say, Freelancer, Matt Barry, and, you know, what are the health metrics? Like, he's got 1,000 things which he could be using to determine whether it's a good month, bad month.
And we do see the screens in the office.
I do enviously see some of the dashboard stuff up there. I mean, what are the headline things that you use to take a temperature read on how you're tracking?
Look, I look at daily all of the I look at it when I can, all of the feedback and all of the conversations that are going on with new leads. And I look at the back and forward between our customer success team and what the customers are saying. Then I look at our reviews, and Sign is the highest rated company in our peer group, and the feedback. I look at the feedback all the time as the primary indicator. I look at how many people are trialing Sign and are in the pipeline, and then look at the conversion rates and ultimately the finances. So
how do you make a strategic call on feedback though? Because there is that fine line. You get might be one nutter or just one bad experience, and you could make a big call and change a big aspect of the business or one piece of feedback. How do you walk that fine line?
It's a weighted process, so we don't just act on it immediately. Mm. In the early days, in the first 6 months of Sign, that there was a lot of very fast implemented feedback, but it was all pretty on the money in retrospect. That early feedback that was implemented quickly took us down a pretty good roadmap path. Now, we don't change our roadmap unless, or add to our roadmap unless, clients of a significant nature say, look, we really need to do this. So we have done some things to accelerate our roadmap, but basically the team in this office here in Adelaide now, where all of our core R&D is done, have been together now for 3 years. So our engineering team, our product team, our Q&A team, they're all good at solving the problems in our domain. And that's what I'm really excited about going forward, is we've had the right people at the right time in the right place, co-located, doing things together, solving these problems. And it's like any team, sport or other industrial process or software process, you've got to have all these people thinking about the strategic vision and the roadmap. And I think we've got a pretty good one.
Come to that Adelaide theme. What, I guess, do you see your role, if any, as someone who has successfully been through the exit process and you've lodged back in Adelaide and there's a bubbling away of lots of young people now having a crack. You know, how do you see it play out and what your role is?
Yeah. I think, Adelaide is a really good place to run any business. It's got sensible cost metrics, so you can get back here, you can get a premises, you can get people involved with you that are happy being here. I think that we are in a really good environment where the prices to do things are not like Sydney and Melbourne, which compared to Silicon Valley are nothing. But if you were to set up a business like Sign and bootstrap it in Silicon Valley, the whole emphasis that you see around tech is always about the raise. You hardly ever hear about the team or the product that they're or the problem that they're solving. It's all about who did what around the raise. And that worries me that technology is all about that. Whereas if you come to a place like Adelaide or some of the other capitals around the world that are not Silicon Valley, you can start to sort of bring together a round and get some investors together and build something that's really good without it all being around about the raise through, you know, sophisticated VCs or whatnot. They can come later. So Adelaide is a really good platform to do that. But actually what it's about is distractions. Adelaide is a really good place to stay focused. We've got, it's pragmatic things like the airport here and getting to the airport and getting out of the airport and getting back to see your family and not being stuck in traffic and not being frustrated.
That's why we hate Melbourne.
Yeah. So
it kills me.
So going to Melbourne for meetings, is really good because there's good clients in Melbourne, but getting there and coming back and doing all that stuff is a nightmare.
Yeah.
So actually Sydney's pretty good for that.
Yeah.
It's pretty good to get in and out of Sydney and Adelaide. But the lifestyle here, again, cliches and everything else, but it is a really, really good place. There's actually nothing really missing here. The only thing that we need to be doing more of in Adelaide is having more things like South Start, having more conversations like this, and just not high-fiving each other and saying how awesome we are, but just discussing business.
I don't think that would hurt, actually. There's a lot of crap stuff peddled around, so
true.
I don't think it hurts.
Yep.
Is there something to be said for flying under the radar a little bit? Like even looking into your story and the Sign story, yeah, there's coverage of it, but I don't think it's not at the level of some coverage that I've seen of other companies and other founders who perhaps may live somewhere else or perhaps may have
done less.
Yeah, who've done less but have an ability to talk themselves up. I don't know. It just seemed to me that you guys are very much under the radar for where you could be for the things that you've done.
I think the reality of it is it's not deliberate under the radar. It's just being so focused and busy that the PR side of things just comes naturally. And I've never been a founder that has sought it out. I like talking, as you can tell. I like engaging with the media, and I have some really good friends in the media. But it's not something that is at the focus of what we do. Maybe that will change if the company really scales and we look at listings or things like that. Not that we are at this point in time, but there's too many other things to be focused on. But it's also a double-edged sword of not letting other young entrepreneurs or business people in Adelaide know that it's a great place and they should take some risk.
Mm. My last question before we come to our world-famed, what is it?
Rapid fire.
Wow.
World-famed.
World-famous.
What's it called?
I couldn't remember. I guess the last question is what, you know, can be very broad, but in essence, what do you see your role within this team being?
Joining the dots. So you have to be just the person that is continually obviously thinking about the company's welfare, everyone's welfare internally here, but just facilitating problem solving, finance, billing, product, sales, just being the point person to continually remind people about thinking about things in a positive way or a lateral way. And you also got to be the person where when problems arrive that you actually think them through and try and come up with a solution. And then learning to step back and let your team get on with it and not hover around them all the time.
Very good. Now, rapid fire. We're kicking it off. I'm notoriously shit at it, hence why I've...
He has one bullet. He delivers the bullet and then it's got nothing to back us up.
Well, it's because I'm holding up the majority of the interview, James. Come on. So if looking at the Sign journey so far, what's the one moment that has filled you with pride?
Watching the team grow, watching everyone here, you know, make a success of it, and also playing beach cricket watching my team play beach cricket against each other on the beach at Aldinga.
I'd like to make a comment.
That's not
a
moment. This is why rapid fire.
That's not a moment. Yeah, that is a sequence of many moments.
That's a lifestyle. That's a lifetime of events.
Exactly. Is there one particular moment, like winning a certain client, something happened, you hit a certain number out there on your dashboard? I don't know. Is it something like that?
Reaching 10 million people checked in on the platform.
Favorite cheesy film that you distributed via Love Film that you actually enjoy watching?
Oh, probably something like Jeepers Creepers. Horror films were the thing of the day.
Outside of Adelaide, a city that you just love spending time in.
Wow.
And okay. Why?
Just came back from Queenstown.
Awesome.
Mountain biking, lakes, water, Kiwi accent.
What a person that has been incredibly influential in your business journey, and it can't be anything to do with your parents.
Good question. I'd say one of my advisory board members, a guy called Chris Key, who's also a fellow entrepreneur. He's been very influential and he's now running a major corporation here in Australia.
What would you be doing if you weren't running Sign?
Tending to my father's vineyard.
The jargon that you hate most associated with startup world.
The ecosystem.
What would be the one song that would be the soundtrack to your song can't be a soundtrack to a life, can it?
Well, if you've got a short life.
If you're going to summarize your life into 3 to 5 minutes, what would be the song that would be the soundtrack to it?
Ring of Fire.
My last question is, you mentioned podcasts off air, so 3 podcasts that you load up on an international flight. You're more than welcome to check it. Absolutely, check it.
Looking into, I haven't listened to him yet, but I am going to download, I have downloaded it. Joe Rogan, I think's next one to really start getting into, obviously because they're Elon Musk, but there's heaps of other stuff, that's going on there. And then Reid Hoffman's Masters of Scale. I've been really getting into that. And then some TED Talk stuff is really interesting. Pretty much the 3 that I'm looking at now.
Well, Anthony, look, mate, thank you so much for finding some space for us in your global business. And as someone who really envies people who have been there and done that and gone through the exit process, I've really enjoyed being able to sit down with you for an hour. So thanks for being on Rooster Radio.
Awesome, guys. Really good to meet you, and keep up the great work.
Thanks for your contribution to the ecosystem.
Yeah,
exactly.
Hope you enjoyed our chat with Anthony Serravolo. Make sure you check out Anthony and many other awesome speakers at Southstart. Open your browser right now and visit southstart.co and get involved. Connect with Rooster Radio and listen to more than 100 interviews with interesting people doing amazing things at roosterradio.biz. And if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast player. Thanks for listening.